the biggest entrepreneur destination on the planet. This is Business Rockstars, and I have a rock star for you right now. We've got Rob Mondavi Jr. He is a winemaker and the co-founder of Michael Mondavi Family Estate. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, great to be here. Great to come in and talk a little bit about the wines and what makes our crazy business tick.
And you brought wine, which is even better, so we already like you.
Thank the Lord. And you know what? I tried to bring two that are pretty interesting. Something a little more classic with the Cabernet Sauvignon, and then rosés are just hot in the marketplace
today.
They
are so hot. I am the target audience, being a female millennial. Love me some rosé.
Yep.
But let's talk about your winery. Tell me a little bit about it and how you grew up in the wine business.
Growing up in the wine business is incredible. The irony is you don't know it's incredible until you essentially move out from your very beautiful and insular space. But you grow up in the wine business, you see things and you do things that are just beautiful and very focused in your industry. And our industry is so rich with wine and food pairings, great chefs coming in. I remember being a child and getting to meet Julia Child. I mean, and you know,
so cool.
I offered, of course, to let her ride my brand new 10-speed bicycle at the time, and the poor thing had no idea what to do with that. But it's great though, because you meet these wonderful icons of the industry, and they become, you know, part of the world you live and grow up in. So they don't seem anything different than a family friend. And you start to get out into the world and realize then how profoundly special it is and was that I got to hang with Julia Child when I was 12 years old.
That is so cool. And then not to mention just the invaluable skills you must have gained learning from your family and just growing up in the business. So tell me some things that you learned growing up that now you still keep with you today as a winemaker.
Yeah, you know, my family's always been a proponent of green farming. You know, we didn't have the quote green farming term, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, but we always felt a compelling need to farm in a healthful, responsible way. When you live in the vineyards and your kids are running around the vineyards, you want to make sure what you're doing is healthy. What you're putting into the vineyards is A, good for you, and B, is going to be good for your family and good for the people who then be drinking your wines. So green farming and sustainability has always been a part of what we do, even though we didn't necessarily have the right catchphrase back then.
And what was it like working with your family growing up?
Sticky. Literally sticky, and not being cheeky, because everything in the winery when the grapes come in is covered with sugar. The grapes are about 26 degrees sugared, and everything that they come in contact with has this beautiful little sticky film on it, and it's sweet. You know, you can't help but smell it and feel it in the air. So when you grow up in that environment, you have a heightened sense of smell, heightened sense of taste, and you love it. And everything about the valley when the fermentations are going on is perfumed and aromatic, and there's a bustle. So it's a whole community that changes and ebbs and flows and evolves around the grape harvest to make these beautiful products.
It sounds amazing, but I will say a lot of people advise you to not work with family. So are there any cons to working with family?
There's always cons to working with family, but the pros outweighs the cons. Now, the cons, I think, are fairly obvious, though. At the end of the day, when you want to hang your shovel and you want to just relax and maybe vent about the day, who do you vent to?
Yeah.
You know, when you and there's hierarchy in any company, and you know, if your dad's the top of the food chain at the time, then you know, you're complaining about your boss, but you're also, you know, lamenting about then family. So you have to be very careful of how you balance taking it personally because it's dad, or is it because this is my CEO and he wants
right.
more research, he wants more data on a project. And I think once an individual and a collective family can learn to compartmentalize what is business and what is personal, it runs easier. But how do you separate that? It is.
It's tricky, but yeah, the more you can, the better. Great advice on that. And you did decide to leave the family business and wine for a little bit. Was that a good decision? And what did you learn?
It was a great decision. And we have to digress to the question of why, though. So after university, my sister and I wanted to be in their original company, and we wanted to apply for management positions, my mom and dad wanted my sister and I to be outside the wine industry and outside our business specifically for at least 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Go out, learn something different, stub your toe. Understand that when a boss tells you no, or that you need to go do your homework a little bit deeper, or here's a great success, that this is part of life. And I chose a few different businesses. I was in the cigar business and made cigars in Central America and imported them and distributed them throughout the United States. And that was a kick. That was a tremendous experience, and I loved it. But it also, when you go outside of the family business, yes, there is the lost time of being in the family business, but there's the gain of what is out there in the world, and there is the gain that you want to be within your family business. So then when you come back into it, it's not just a passion because you grew up in it, it's a passion and a calling that you return to.
And that's amazing that it still is a passion, because sometimes people grow up in a family business and they go, oh, this would be easy to stay with the family business. Yes. It would be lucrative, but I'm just not passionate about it. But obviously, you must be so passionate about wine, too.
I love it.
Yeah. Amazing. So at what point did you guys co-found and start Michael Mondavi Winery?
Great. And that's the transition between the Robert Mondavi Winery and then when we left there and started the Michael Mondavi Family Estate. And this is this lovely little, ball of twine that's confusing. So digressing in history, the fast history is
that. Yes, please inform us.
My grandfather Robert and my father Michael Mondavi in 1966 had their first vintage at the Robert Mondavi Winery. From 66 until 2004, the family was together. We were public for a blink of an eye from 94 to 2004. And in 2004, that moment in time happened where Dad and I decided, and my sister decided, it was time to leave the Robert Mondavi and to start something small and personal again. And then shortly thereafter, the Robert Mondavi Winery sold to a large drinks company out of New York. So we decided that we wanted to be back to what was important to us, which was making small lot, beautifully well-thought wines. What I brought in today to show you is something classic. We have our Cabernet here, which is only 1,000 cases, but it's very, very much more formal, very elegant, and then something fun. So we want to be able to have wines that address what's the market trend today, and then we also want to be able to have wines that are very stately, very focused, that we can lay down in the cellar for whether it's a year or whether it's 5 years or 30 years.
And because you are a little bit smaller, you probably can pivot quicker and stay on trend faster, right?
Oh, absolutely. So my sister, back to family business, right? My sister created this package here on the rosé, and it's just beautiful, this creative bottle of silkscreen and a new top, which addresses some of the closure issues of the time. This is almost what I call an apothecary-style top. So it's easy to get to, easy to open, easy to close back up and store and reuse, and I love that.
Yeah, that's amazing. So tell me a little bit more about your role in the business now. Like, what is a typical day like, if there is one?
A typical day doesn't have a nice jacket on here. A typical day is, jeans, some hiking boots, and then I have to have a shirt too. But, and then into the vineyards or into the winery. And the vineyards for me are tantamount to the success of a great wine. So we spend a very disproportionate amount of time in the vineyards and making sure that everything is set up so that when we do bring the grapes into the vineyards, that it's about as close to a layup as you can get. And so vineyards and winemaking are where I spend my day.
That's awesome. And I know that you said that having that family touch on a winery really, really helps a winery be successful. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
It's to me, how does one look at the responsibility of carrying a wine year after year and then looking at the generation that came before you and then the next generation to come? And I think that there's a heightened level of responsibility when you look at your own tradition and you look at then what you hope to pass to your children if they're interested in it. So I think that by having family-owned and family-operated wineries, there's a heightened sense of being, a heightened sense of what is going into the bottle, and a heightened sense of what quality you want stamped in there, because wine is living and breathing, and it can last generations.
How do you strike that balance between carrying on the family legacy, but also making it your own, too, and staying with the times and being progressive in your industry?
It's tough, and we've addressed that question in a little bit of a different way within our family collection of wines. So I brought two for us to talk about. One's Isabel Mondavi, and the other's Animo, but we have a third one, really, called Emblem. And so we have to have wines that are more trendy, and then the next level up, Emblem, which is a little more trendy, but also can be traditional, so it's not tacking quickly. And then, lastly is your highest tier wine, which really should be able to be sat down in front of somebody in Bordeaux or a wine collector from around the world, whether it's 10 years ago or 10 years in advance. That allows the individual family members, as they're coming up through the ranks, to have different levels of creativity.
Yeah.
And it's a really neat way to look at it. I love the fact that if I look at a fashion house, I can see that a fashion house 50 years ago has the images that it does today, but it is completely new and avant-garde and current in the moment, yet it still has that semblance of the past and the history of the past.
That's a really great analogy. I love it. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about breaking into the wine industry. Is it possible if you didn't grow up in a family winery? We're going to answer that and so much more when we come back. We are the biggest entrepreneur destination on the planet. This is Business Rockstars.
Hey, I just heard that people at my friend's company got sextortion emails.
Yeah, it's a popular type of spear phishing attack.
Wow, that sounds serious.
It is. Scammers claim to have a compromising video of the victim and threaten to share it with their contact list unless they pay a ransom.
What if they target someone at our company?
We're secured with Barracuda Sentinel. It uses artificial intelligence to block spear phishing attacks, including sextortion emails.
That's a relief.
Protect your business at Barracuda.com. Barracuda, your journey secured.
Hi, I'm Mike Ditcher. On the field, they called me Iron Mike. But some days, even Iron Mike can feel a little rusty. So I turned to Blue Emu. Blue Emu's non-greasy, deep-penetrating formula gets down deep for big-time comfort. And more importantly, it doesn't leave me smelling like a locker room. Now, if you excuse me, I have some yelling to do. You hit like old men! Blue Emu. It works fast and you won't stink.
The biggest entrepreneur destination on the planet. This is Business Rockstars, and we continue our conversation now with Rob Mondavi Jr. He is a winemaker and the co-founder of Michael Mondavi Family Estate. So obviously you had the benefit of growing up in wineries, but is it possible to break into the industry if you didn't?
You know, it is. And I say it is with a little spring and emphasis because I love it when new people are coming into the industry. You do get a little jealous, but let's talk about why, though. Because I think when new people are coming into our business, they're coming in because they have a great passion for it. This business is a tough business economically to profit. It takes time. We have a long capital cycle, a long ROI cycle. So people coming into this business have a passion for what they're doing. And when people have a passion for what they are doing, they tend to make great products. And they seek out the best ways to do that, new technologies, new opportunities, and just little nuances that make wine one step better. So I'm happy that they can come in and that they can get started.
What if they don't know the technology piece or the agriculture piece, I should say? Is that something you can get help with?
Absolutely. And today is probably the richest opportunity that we've had in the last half century for somebody from outside the industry to come into the industry. Today, there are remarkable winemaking consultants who are available for hire. Now, granted, you have to come with the right idea, the right capital to do that, but there are some beautiful names there, whether it be names that are generational in Napa Valley, names that are the darling of the press at the current moment who are putting out just beautiful scores. So we do have winemaking expertise available. We also have vineyard expertise available. People can come in and buy a vineyard and then retain a consultant specific to vineyard management. They can also come into Napa Valley, and if they're not ready to purchase land or purchase a vineyard, they can find a broker who can help them acquire grapes by the ton is how we sell them. And then it's about 65 cases a ton, so you can do a little bit of math and figure out what you need to get started.
Yeah.
But it's nice that it is accessible for people. And I like to believe that most of the time when people are coming in, they have the right intentions to make something great. Occasionally someone makes some plonk, but they tend to leave fairly quickly.
But like you said, most people have the passion, and you touched on that you need capital to start a business, and you have had capital when you've started your businesses. So what advice do you have for making your money go a long way?
Well, the first advice I would have is don't go into the wine business. But, and I say that with, you know, cheeky love. Because on so when you come into the wine industry, you typically need about 2 to 3 years before you'll have a return. So if I harvested this Cabernet Sauvignon this particular year, realistically, I would have to wait 24 to 36 months for it to hit the marketplace. That's a long capital hit. So what I recommend for people who want to come into this business is you have to understand your ROI models. And I would have at least 5 to 7 years of available capital. Expect net negative for at least the first 5 years, and then net neutral 5-6, and then profit after that. It's a long capital intensive
business. So yeah, you really got to be passionate.
Passionate, patient, and willing to persevere, because then you have the market cycles on top of that. So it is beautiful, though. But once you are in this, you're involved with agriculture. You're involved with the seasonality of just the sun, the winter, the spring, the fall. You have it all there. And then you have this beautiful product to come with as well. So I do think that having the great business plan, of course, that's standard blocking and tackling. The right idea with the wine and the right venue to market it. Are your friends going to buy the wine? Will they buy the wine the second and the third time? So one has to be very careful, because cellars fill up quickly. And it is lovely, though, because it is a product that not only can you age, but if you encourage your friends, they tend to help you drink.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you are self-funded, so this is especially maybe accessible for somebody who can self-fund their business. Are there investors in this space? Is it something where you can get investors and start a winery?
There are opportunities for that. I've seen that with some of my friends who I've grown up with, who have decided that they wanted to, instead of taking all the opportunity and all the risk as well for themselves, they've opened up the opportunity and they've invited investors to come in. And being an investor in the wine business has some remarkable perks. First and foremost, there's access to the wines. Secondly, you tend to invest into a group of experts who are going to handle the winemaking and the vineyards and the go-to-market strategies, and then you get to partake in that. So it is possible to either start something and to gain investors, or to find really beautiful high-tier wine companies to invest into. It's all private market. It's all word of mouth. It's very sub sigillum, but it's wonderful. So I know if you want it, you can find it.
And I know that you're a big fan of having mentors.
Yes.
Can you speak to that a little bit?
So I'm very lucky. I've had different mentors across the board, whether it's a business mentor who I look to for my father, Michael Mondavi, who really helped to create Napa Valley and the California wine industry. You're not going to find a better mentor than him. He's seen it, done it, built it, and then done it again. So, and I always think that my father is remarkably and one of the best teachers I've ever seen. So, you know, I like to learn from him, and I always encourage him to please, you know, have more speaking engagements. Go to Davis, go to Fresno, speak more, because he has so much to offer. Winemaking mentors, then, different type of topic. Finding someone who will not just tell you, you know, what should you do when the rains are coming? Do I pick now? Do I wait? But someone who will inspire you to think and to challenge you to draw it out of yourself to make these decisions. And I had a great mentor like that with Tony Coltrane, who I've knew since, oh, goodness gracious, since 1973 I've known him. So, you know, finding the mentors that you can trust who will inspire you. And to me, a mentor is one that pulls the answer out of you, but one that doesn't give it to you.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Now, obviously, winemaking business, very competitive business.
Yes.
Everyone's got their own theory on what makes you stand out, differentiate yourself from the competition. Is it the label? Is it the price point? Maybe it's several things. Can you speak to what makes you stand out and competitive in this industry?
You know, as an industry, it's a little bit of everything. And fortunately, there's great market analytics. You know, we can understand if you want to be a California AVA wine and you're $10.99 a bottle. That is one set of matrix that is great. You know, you need the supermarket channel, and then you need to go beyond that. You need your advertising, your funding. That is big business. That is hundreds of thousands of cases. It is a tough category to enter. Profit margins are even more narrow. As we move from a bigger region then into Sonoma, Napa, we start to find that your brands can be smaller. There tends to be a higher investment level on a per case basis or per acre basis if you're investing there, but there also is then the return as well. I like being smaller. I like being focused. I love the craft orientation of being hands-on. you know, walking in the vineyards, creating the fermentations and so on. That's where I really enjoy it. But to gain that entry, whether it's the volume tier or the high tier, there is information out there and there is information available. I personally think Silicon Valley Bank is probably the most astute and it has the best depth of information available. And I truthfully think that they are quite brilliant in how they analyze the market.
Really good stuff. Thank you so much for your time and all of your insight. What a fun industry you're in.
Well, I love that you had me today, and thank you for talking about wine. It's a great passion of mine and the family, and look for more to come from us.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Rob Mondavi Jr., he's a winemaker and co-founder of Michael Mondavi Family Estate, and we are the biggest entrepreneur destination on the planet. This is Business Rockstars.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Jeff Olson. If bath time is a tough time at your house, you're not alone.
It is not uncommon for there to be a huge debate and discussion about who should bathe, how often, and with what and why.
Mayo Clinic dermatologist Dr. Dawn Davis is about to settle this sudsy debate. So kids, listen up.
For young infants and children between the ages of 6 to 12, it's best to wash or take a bath approximately 2 to 3 days a week.
Dr. Davis says once they hit puberty, teens should have a shower or bath every day, or at minimum every other day.
There are caveats to this. At any time in life when you develop excessive sweat or become very dirty, then you should bathe.
And here's something that may surprise kids and parents alike. You should bathe after swimming.
The truth of the matter is that natural and artificial water sources can still have a lot of germs.
So after you hit the beach or the pool, plan to hit the shower too. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
Welcome back to Business Rockstars. Now let's go to Mark Lack.
This is Business Rockstars. I'm Mark Lack, and we're here to inspire, inform, and connect a community of entrepreneurs. We've got Rob Jacobs, the chief unsitter of Unsit. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be on, Mark. Really looking forward to it.
We've never had a chief unsitter on the show before, I'll tell you that.
I think there's only two in the world that I know of, myself and my partner up in Seattle.
There you go. So why don't you tell us what your company does?
Our mission is to unsit the world, America we're starting with, in offices, workplaces, homes, and schools. And we want to get people up out of their chairs and moving again.
And there's got to be some health benefits behind this. Can't just be telling everybody to stand.
No, an enormous amount of health benefits, Mark. It turns out I've been in the health and fitness business all my professional life. I don't want to date myself, but going back to the 1980s, I was in the Jane Fonda aerobics music, the aerobics movement, doing exercise classes, mostly to meet girls at the time, but also was a great way to get in shape. But I got into the fitness equipment business. Yeah. We outfitted movie stars and people of wealth with high-end custom home gym equipment. Then we got into commercial equipment. So I've always been involved in exercise and fitness equipment. And then became a program director at the Pritikin Longevity Center in Santa Monica, where we use treadmills to pace people through an exercise program. Uh-huh. Subsequent to that, I started a store called the Walking Center in Beverly Hills. And the Walking Center was all about using treadmills and walking as a modality to get into fitness and exercise.
Okay.
And the treadmills are unique to other exercise equipment because they pace you. They keep you going and keep you moving. Yeah. Whereas if you're sitting on an exercise bike in a spinning class,
you can stop.
You can stop and you have to use your mental ability to motivate yourself to go, or a teacher in a spinning class to make
or
you
go. Or a treadmill's
going
to keep going.
It's always keep going. You have to keep up. And it's a perfectly natural movement. We're born to walk. Our bodies are engineered and mechanically to walk. It's a perfectly natural
motion. Let's talk about some of those health benefits real quick, because I don't want people to tune out real quick, because it's like, oh, it's about, you know, standing and not sitting down. Health benefits, short and sweet. Give us here's why sitting is bad and here's why standing is good.
Yeah, well, here it is. Sitting has a plethora of health ailments that are rooted in sitting. The guy who put all the science behind this is a guy named Dr. James Levine out of the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, who studied movement and came to the conclusion that sitting is the real cause. The issues are when you sit, your calorie burn drops to darn near zero. The reason is your brain gets a signal that you're going to sleep because there's no weight on your feet. Mm. When you put weight on your feet, your brain gets a signal that we're awake, there's threats, there's opportunities, let's go after them, and metabolism revs up. and you start to burn calories. When you sit, calorie burn drops to zero, or near zero, and that's a big health problem. The cardiovascular system is strained. It drops very low. You're putting pressure on the back of the legs and the glutes where there's not supposed to be pressure. It starts to cut circulation. The lumbar spine arches the wrong way, so you get pressure on the disc. That leads to sciatica and all kinds of other low back ailments. Then people start rounding shoulders. Neck comes forward. You get cervical neck problems, and there's if you look and talk to people who are working in offices for a long period of time, those are big health ailments. Then blood sugar burn drops very low. So you're sitting, you're going to sleep, you need a cup of coffee and a donut, so blood sugar goes skyrocketing up.
I don't know if that's a breakfast, but
people reach
a lot of people unfortunately do, though. That is a breakfast for a lot of people.
It is, unfortunately, and even if it's a healthy breakfast, you're taking in a lot of calories, a lot of sugar. Your body has no way to burn it because you're stuck in a chair. If you're out moving, you could burn that sugar up, but you're stuck in a chair and no way to burn it. So now the pancreas is overloaded. Insulin spikes. This leads to obesity. This leads to diabetes and a whole plethora of health ailments that come out of sitting. Creativity also drops, and so does productivity. And that's the area that our company is interested in. We believe strongly that the health benefits are kind of obvious. People know about it. Yeah. You get people up out of your chair and moving, you'll have a tremendous lift in your physical energy level. But we've also found that I've personally found in my life that creativity improves. Mm. Productivity improves. I get more done. I'm taking in a lot less caffeine. In fact, I'm down to zero now. Yeah. I get to the end of the day, there's no afternoon lull. You know, I'm energetic. I'm ready to go. I don't feel like I'm spent. I haven't had a workout yet. I still do a regular fitness program.
Okay.
But there's no nodding off in the afternoon. I'm creative. I'm productive. I'm getting more done.
All from just standing.
I'm mostly walking because I have a what I call a walking desk. Most people are calling it a treadmill desk.
Yeah.
We've dubbed it a walking desk because it's a desk you can be walking at.
So standard treadmill. I know you can buy them. You can actually buy a specific walking desk, treadmill desk.
Right. So what we've done, my partner and I were in the fitness equipment business for many years. All the treadmill desks that are out there, they've just taken a standard fitness treadmill, a little bit of fine tuning to it, and they've stuck it under a desk. The problem there is the treadmill for fitness is narrow. You're stuck in one line. You can't, if there's something over there on your desk, you can't get it. So we made the treadmill twice as wide. So it takes up the whole space under your desk. You can now walk and use the whole width of your desk. You can meander around, kind of like meandering on a walk, and get a lot more use out of it.
Well, you said you wish you were going to bring one. I do too. Now we're going to have to cut B-roll shots in of this walking desk.
I've got some great shots you can cut in, or I can come back out with a treadmill desk and do a shoot out in the common area. We also made the treadmill half as long. Most fitness treadmills are about 5 feet long, so it uses a lot of space behind your desk, which in a tight office situation is undesirable. So we reformatted the whole shape of the treadmill. We engineered it to go extremely slow, because when you're working at a desk, you're not running, you're not doing a workout.
Yeah.
You just want to keep your legs moving, because if you stand, I started out as a standing desk, and I found very quickly you can't stand more than about 10, 15 minutes, your legs start to get achy. And the reason your legs are getting achy is they're not moving, and you've got blood flow going down to the legs. It can't get back up to get reoxygenated, and you get achy legs.
So ironically, standing still at a desk is more tiring than walking at a desk.
That's what I found, and that's what the science proves, is that you can stand for about 10 or 15 minutes and you start to get leg fatigue. There's no circulation and it's uncomfortable. And that's why people start moving around. They start putting their feet up. They end up going back to sitting. But you can walk all day long and there's no achy legs. It's a fantastic experience.
And you're burning calories, staying awake, staying focused, staying creative.
Exactly. Now, just want to caveat to people to know that there are a lot of times I do pause the treadmill if I'm doing very precise manual work, graphics on a computer or a detailed spreadsheet. There are times I'll hit pause.
You don't want to be moving up and down a little bit.
Right. You just want to hold it. There are times you want to pause.
Yeah.
So I don't walk all day long, but I walk out probably about 60, 70% of the
day. And I think it's about making those micro commitments.
That's correct.
You don't have to do this thing for 10 hours. Just start doing it a little bit and start to incrementally replace the amount of time sitting with standing or walking.
That's right. So I'll tell you my personal story, Mark. What happened to me is a friend of mine came to me, wanted to build a treadmill desk. And I thought it was a silly idea. I thought this whole thing with the idea of just slow walking is exercise. I was very skeptical because I'm a fitness guy. My background is getting people to 80% of max heart rate for 20 minutes, four times a week, you know, this kind of exercise prescription. So I was a skeptic. But when I started tinkering around with it myself, I started out with a piece of plywood on an old treadmill, and I just started fashioning a desk and seeing what it was like to work at a desk. I would start out doing about 15, 20 minutes at a time. Then I'd go back to my regular desk. Gradually, over about 6 months, that flipped where I was no longer using my sitting desk. I was 100% at my treadmill desk, and I now have gotten rid of, I sold on eBay 4 state-of-the-art Herman Miller Aeron chairs that I had in my home office. My wife, my two kids, we all had a Herman Miller Aeron chair. They're gone, sold them on eBay, and we all have standing and treadmill desks. And we, We do it all the time. So I just completely migrated over.
That's awesome.
And a lot of this, Mark, is about integrating exercise into your whole lifestyle.
Yeah.
So when I grew up, people would work all day in the office, then you have your gym bag and you go over to the gym and work out for an hour after you spent all day sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a separate compartmentalized lifestyle.
Yeah.
But now, younger people and myself too, we want to integrate it.
Yeah.
So my whole day is about moving and exercise. I don't get to I don't have that end of the day feeling where, oh, I'm whipped. I've got to get to the gym because I've been sitting all day.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anymore in my lifestyle.
Okay. I love that. And you just basically summed it up right there, is it's finding a way to integrate a healthier lifestyle in with your daily routine. We've got the chief unsitter officer right here with us of Unsit, Rob Jacobs. This is Business Rockstars. I'm Mark Lack, and we're here to inspire, inform, and connect a community of entrepreneurs. I want to know, you were saying that for companies, right, and schools, it's about increasing productivity and having an actual tangible return on how standing helps produce better results for the company. So
right.
Who's the exact client profile for what you ideally teach and sell this to? Is it the consumer? Is it companies that have a return on seeing how, all of a sudden all of our salespeople and telemarketers started standing and the results, tripled or 30%.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you brought up telemarketers because there was a study done in a call center, and call centers are a great place to study this
I've
stuff.
Read many studies about how important it is as a telemarketer to stand for the physiology and your tonality shift from standing versus sitting.
Yeah. Standing. And then if you're moving adds to it, and but not just telemarketers, even customer service call centers, people get fatigued, they get tired. So, and there's been some good studies where they've shown increased productivity measured by how many calls did they field, the satisfaction of the people they're talking to.
If I'm tired and I hear a bunch of no's, my energy goes down, my morale goes down, my motivation goes down, therefore my amount of calls goes down, and that has a direct impact on the bottom line of the company.
100%. And in addition, long-term, bigger companies who are self-insured or are paying high premiums for insurance for people, they know that long-term, those people are going to be health risks. They're going to have obesity, they're going to have diabetes, they're going to have low back problems, musculoskeletal issues, all related to sitting. So they want to get people up out of the chair as many hours a day as they can.
Okay.
So we just launched at the end of 2016, and we're just getting going now. Some of our sales are to some of these larger companies who are looking for a way to integrate this. Some have just put one or two in, and they've got people, it's a shared desk situation where workers can come up from their regular desk and do 20, 30 minutes of walking. A lot of executives have bought these. Interestingly enough, Mark, lawyers are the profession that buys them the most. Lawyers really like treadmill desks. We've got a number of people because they're doing a lot of briefing, a lot of dictating, a lot of conference calls. Conference calls, webinars, people who are watching this show right now, if you're sitting down, you should be up at a treadmill desk.
I bet there's people listening right now that have already stood up if they're not driving or if they're at their office or something, right?
That's right.
In a situation where they can't.
Because look, as all of us in today's modern work lifestyle, we're on conference calls, we're on Skype calls, we're on webinars. That's a perfect time to be up and walking. There's no reason to be sitting for an experience like that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that. I'm a huge advocate of health and finding always different ways. That's why the first thing I said was one of those stand-up boards. I was like, oh, we both, right?
No, great.
And we had that guy on the show. It's like stand-up boards is something that's a trend, new types of mats. I even saw something, I don't know if it was on Shark Tank or if it was just an ad that I saw online. And it was a new platform of a thing like this for your desk you sat on, and then you can put your laptop, your computer, whatever, and you just simply give it a little push and it unlocks and then lifts up. And so it goes from a sit down desk to a stand up desk anytime you want.
Yep.
So let's say somebody wants to get on the early bird list, or maybe they even want to just check you out and what you're doing.
Yeah.
Where can they go and see more about this?
Well, unsit.com is our website. Okay. We've got a Facebook page, unsit.greatmindsmove. That's our tagline.
Okay.
And we've got some reviews coming out in the next couple of months, and we're on Business Rockstars.
It's hard, and you're on Business Rockstars. It's hard to get a URL domain that's five letters, unsit. And you guys were able to lock one in. That's pretty cool.
Yep. Thank you. It took a little bit of negotiating, but we did it.
I'm excited to see this thing take off. And I'm going to have to check it out. I'm going to have to check it out for myself. So.
Mark, I'm hoping that by the time I come back for our next interview, this set will be equipped with walking desks. I'd be happy to supply them.
We'll have a full stand-up interview studio. We'll be the only guys doing stand-up interviews.
I'll provide the equipment. All your interviews should be up and walking, and I'll be happy to come back and set it up for you guys.
Rob, it was a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you, Mark.
Appreciate you.
All right.
I'm Mark Lack. This is Business Rockstars. We connect a community of entrepreneurs. You can join us on Facebook, Twitter, and online at businessrockstars.com.
The only way to grow your business is to stay focused on your priorities. Here's a few quick ways to keep your startup on track. I'm Alex Worley with a Business Rockstars Minute.
Number one, write down your priorities. If you're going to prioritize successfully, you absolutely must establish a set of goals and write them down. With so many things competing for your time, it's not going to work keeping them in your head. Number two, focus your efforts. Limit the number of things you're working on. Finish one thing before you start another. Choose your top priorities and focus on them alone. Number three, spend a little time building for the future. While you're focusing on those tasks that affect your business today, don't lose sight of the future. If you are successful and your business grows, you may need to hire employees or move into a larger space, for instance. Make sure that you're preparing for long-term success. I'm Alex Worley, and this has been a Business Rockstars Minute.
Here's some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or more importantly, if you sign up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare, and MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing program. It's been around for 25 years. They have more than 400,000 members now around the country. And get this, over the years, MediShare members have shared more than $2 billion of each other's medical bills, so they could help share your needs too. And best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is around $500 a month. Your savings could be more or less, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. So if you think you're stuck with a high-cost health plan that doesn't have much to offer, think again. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. There's no pressure. They're super easy to talk to. 844-91-BIBLE. That's 844-91-BIBLE. 844-91-BIBLE.
You shouldn't have to choose a random lawyer who charges expensive hourly rates when you need legal help. But the legal system is so complicated, what other choice do you have when you need help with your business or want to protect your family? Start with LegalZoom. They make it easy. For more than a decade, they've provided a way for regular people like you and me to confidently navigate the legal system. LegalZoom's not a law firm, and that's how they provide such great value. They don't rely on charging you by the hour. Instead, you'll get transparent pricing and customer reviews so you know exactly what you're getting up front. If you need help with incorporation, LLCs, trademarks, last wills, living trusts, and more, LegalZoom's the smart choice. They've got the right people on hand to answer your questions. And if you need legal advice, their network of independent attorneys can provide the straightforward guidance you need in most states. Don't let legal hurdles become an excuse. Go to LegalZoom.com today to start building your own future the right way. To save even more, enter ROCKSTAR in the referral box at checkout. That's LegalZoom.com.
Mark Lack at the CEO Roundtable.
We're here to inspire, inform, and connect a community of entrepreneurs. I'm Mark Lack on Business Rockstars. This is our CEO Roundtable segment, and joining me is two rockstar CEOs. Who are you and what do you do?
Well, my name is Jason Sullivan. I run two companies. One is called Viral On Demand, and like the name sounds, basically we cause stories, initiatives, and brands to go viral on demand. And there's a certain sequence and design that we do that. And also run a business consulting company where we help accelerate the growth of companies and to where they help to help them to get the sustainable flight by design.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, Jason.
Thank you.
And yourself?
My name is Chris Wong. I'm the CEO of a company called LifeSight. You can find us at lifesight.co. Right? And what our company is, we're a digital, way to think about us, we're a digital vault. So we maintain information for individuals and families for them to be better prepared in case life in case life's emergency. So we maintain or will maintain and help manage and collaborate information such as passwords, health information, medical records, as well as even information pertaining to end of life issues.
Well, that sounds like an incredible platform. I'm excited to dive more into what your company's up to. Let's talk about entrepreneurship real quick, guys. When I got started, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, but now that I am one, my whole perception about what the word means is completely different. What do you guys think? What is your definition of entrepreneurship? How do you feel about the word?
Definition of entrepreneurship? You know, it's a scary, scary word. Yeah. You know, everybody, it's not cut out for everybody. It's not for the faint at heart. Like we were talking about a little earlier, you're going to fail. So just expect that. But we need more entrepreneurs. We need more job creators. And we need you. I mean, 70% of the GDP is created by small businesses. So we really need to, you know, incentivize entrepreneurs to open up new businesses. Yeah. That's one of the things that we try to do and to help them navigate those waters when because it is scary to get your company up and running.
But, you know, it's a person that is a risk taker. That's what it means to me.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think we have a similar view. I would add courage. Right.
So there's a long list of things we could add.
Yeah, I mean, courage. I think there's also responsibility to build team, leadership. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneur a lot of times implies a startup. So it's a startup, right? You're taking responsibility for families. You're taking people out of maybe established jobs.
Sure.
Right. So there's all kinds of things that go into executing as an entrepreneur, let's say.
And how, we were talking earlier before the cameras turned on, how many companies have you been involved in and successfully sold and exited?
So I'm a 30-year entrepreneur. So for me, this would be, LifeSite represents my seventh company. Out of the six companies prior to that, three of the companies I started from a piece of paper, and the other three companies I was kind of brought in as quote-unquote the professional management to take them to the next level. But I've sold all six of the companies and looking forward to the seventh.
So you're the guy that people want to be partnering with.
Yeah. Well, I enjoy it, right? Yeah. That's why I'm looking at this company. I expect this company to probably be the most fun and probably the most recognized company.
Run.
Exactly.
When you say that they were started on paper, were any of those on like a bar napkin or something like that?
Well, that's how yours was started, we know.
No, yeah.
Absolutely.
The idea for the first company was I basically was snowed in with my family in Lake Tahoe, mm-hmm. and being snowed in, you can't do anything but at least think about it. So I actually did sit there, wrote the business plan, and then that was back in the heydays when the internet was kind of getting started and money was easily available. So I came back, called the venture capital, and my friend had a check for $5 million at the end of the week.
Oh, my goodness. No. I think that's the fastest path to raising money.
I don't think you can stop there. I think you need to back up just a moment because I had a $5 million check a week later. How is that possible? I mean, is it only people that are totally connected that's possible? Or
like you had to have had, that wasn't your first business.
It was my first business, right? But so we can talk about this because as an entrepreneur, right, a lot of entrepreneurs start right away. I mean, they look at all their friends, they look at all their friends' success, and they just say, this is easy to do, right? All I need to do is just kind of quit my job.
Yeah, my friend did it, my family did it.
Yeah, it works, mm-hmm. But when I started, right, one, I didn't have the guts to do something like that. And so for me, I didn't really do my first company until I was probably like 10 years into my career.
I thought you were going to say 10 years old.
I mowed lawns and delivered papers.
Sure.
You know, I had the courage, right, after 10 years, but I did it after basically learning, right? I had a lot of mentors, learning about what not to do as well as what to do, then had the courage, and then there's so much money available at that time. I just said, well, if all these other people could do something, I could do it as well. So it's network.
Sure.
Network, and, you know, just, I think I get asked a lot, well, how long did it take you? When I started that company, you guys asked the question, how long did it take me to conceive the idea? And I said, it took me 10 years. They said, well, you just started this company last month.
You were the overnight success.
No, it took me 10 years to accumulate the network to raise the money, right, in that
so
one week.
So you've been putting
time.
In the work and the reps to be prepared, which is a lot of times, I mean, that's like kind of like the old saying, right, luck or preparation and opportunity. What is the word? I'm tongue twister right now. Preparation and opportunity meet is luck.
Absolutely.
And so you had 10 years of preparation, and when you had the idea, you already had the network in place to help you.
And of course, I was being facetious when I said overnight success, because other people see that and they go, they have no idea how much ice is underneath the iceberg.
No, you're right.
Right?
Yeah.
And you had that 10 years there, and then all of a sudden, then they see you as success.
Because you say you wrote out a business plan on paper and
I did,
$5 million bucks. So.
Yeah. Well, but Jason, I mean, looked at your bio, right? You had like odd jobs. You mowed lawns and things like that.
I was 8 years old. I started my first lawn mowing business.
So you mentioned that in your bio, right? Because that actually contributed to probably your personality and kind of your leadership skills.
Well, maybe I would hope so in some ways. And yes, but I mean, absolutely. 8 years old, but who's going to say no to an 8-year old that knocks on your door and says, hey, may I mow your lawn? So it was a little easier, I suppose, but I had to do the hard work, right?
Yeah.
So that did condition me for other things. And then also breaking down the ability to knock on the doors, which is important in any business, right?
Sure.
That we're involved with. We constantly have to be knocking on doors and meeting and talking to the right people. So, yeah, that had a lot to do with it.
Guys, as we wrap up our segment here, what is maybe one last little sentence or two of inspiration you can give to those aspiring entrepreneurs that are out there or to those first-time CEOs?
You know, I would say my favorite quote is hope is not a strategy. Mm. You know, so, again, you've got to have intelligence before you can have a strategy. So get about the business as talking to your current customers and your lost customers and your lost prospects and your wish list prospects, and talk to your employees and talk to your senior level executives and be open with them and have an open door policy and get that information that you need
So they can tell you that, hey, we're leaving this on the table, or, you know, we're missing this opportunity, or things like that.
And that's one of the common themes amongst all successful CEOs, is they're very clear on what their purpose is. Guys, I wish we had more time. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Absolutely.
I'm Mark Lack on Business Rockstars. This was a CEO Roundtable. We're here to inspire, inform, and connect a community of entrepreneurs. Join us on Facebook, Twitter, and online at businessrockstars.com.